What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. This is Resistance in Residence, where we profile artists using their gifts to change the world. This week's feature is hip-hop artist, educator, and community advocate, and my comrade, and my brother, someone I've been in the streets with for a while now. I won't age us, my dear. Ross Ceylon. What's happening, Ross?
Hey, free them all power to the people. It's good Grandma. To chat. You know, it's always good to build with you, particularly right now, October, and Black Panther Party History Month. Feels like a great time to be on Law and Disorder, so salute.
Salute, my G. Russ, I would start with the personal. Talk a bit about, and that actually ties directly to your political and your artistic, so it's a good place to start. Where and how did you grow up?
So grew up in Southern California to parents who immigrated from the island of Sri Lanka. Down the SoCal area, Santa Ana, Orange County area, in the 80s and 90s. And then I moved to the Bay in 99 after high school, escaped the Orange Curtain, and came to San Francisco State University, lived in the dorms there for a year, and then moved to Oakland, continued to go to school at SF State, and working with the youth in Oakland from then on. So from about 99 till now, I've been out here in the Bay.
And what was your family like?
Man, my family is interesting, you know, because Sri Lanka had, you know, the civil war and stuff. They came here right before the civil war started. So, you know, post-colonial struggles there, right? Where it's, you know, so-called third world environment, not a lot of opportunities. And some of my family members were more politically minded. I had an auntie and an uncle who were very much revolutionaries. And so when they first came to this country, they were actually working with the party down there in LA and doing a lot of amazing stuff. And so I always had that influence, if not from my direct parents, certainly from my aunties and uncles and cousins of consciousness, you know, and music. Gotta watch the things that you buy. Can't trust it these days, it's online. YA day feeling so dystopic. Leaders of the world, you know them soulless. Minds of goldfish, it's all. Was something that was always in the house. So it's kind of, it's not a coincidence that I do what I do now, because that was an early part of my foundation. So shout out to my auntie Vicky and my uncle, you know.
I don't want to make any assumptions about what people do and do not know, but for edification, where is Sri Lanka? Why was there a civil war? What's the political history?
Man, that's real. Some people may not know, you know. So, yeah, definitely Sri Lanka is an island of about 30 million people that is right south of India. If you look on the map in South Asia, in the Indian subcontinent, you can see the little teardrop shape below India, and that is the island of Sri Lanka. It was it's an ancient place that has a lot of deep historical roots and few different spiritual traditions from Hinduism, Buddhism, as well as there's Christians and Muslims there. But we were colonized first by the Portuguese in 1505, and then the Dutch in 1678, and then the British in 1796. And so having three different European imperialist colonizers has affected the island. Like, for instance, my last name is Portuguese, though I have no Portuguese lineage. You know, that's an effect of colonization. And so in 1948, when so-called independence was granted from the British Empire, the colony of Ceylon, which is where my namesake comes from, became the island of Sri Lanka. However, as happens oftentimes in post-colonial situations, during colonial times, the minority group was given access to more education and more jobs and a higher status, and the majority was left out. So then what happens when independence comes, now the majority group feels like they have to have this ethnic national identity and essentially force all the minorities in the island to be second-class citizens, which created the conditions that sparked the Tamil Tigers to form and started a 27-year-long separatist civil war with the Liberation Tigers of Tamil Eelam versus the Sri Lankan government. And that was from 1983 to 2009. So my whole life, I grew up visiting the island under civil war conditions, and that informed a lot of what I was thinking about and, you know, what I do.
Say more in how that informed how you think, how you view colonialism, how that shaped your politic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. I mean, it really made me think about like, why is it like this? Like these people, like I would visit even as a child and see how friendly and warm and inviting the people are, right? In general, in the island, regardless of their different ethnic background, religious background, language, everyone was really friendly and nice. But then we had this brutal, long civil war, and it really was confusing to me. So then, as a student of history, I had to go back and look and see, okay, what were the conditions that were created during 500 years of colonial rule? That's a long time. There's several generations that have been impacted by that, right? And so it really made me think about, divide and conquer and how that plays out, even dealing with street tribes or what we call gangs here in California as a youth, seeing that parallel between the Civil War and then, so-called gang warfare that was happening here in California, really made me understand that a lot of these divisions that we have are set up by the system on purpose to keep our people divided, So it really gave me a mind towards working on points of unity and finding and coalition building as a youngster. And also the whole concept of decolonizing your mind to understand what was the impact of that colonial era that we're still in many ways.
2009, the year the Civil War ended. That's also the year that Oakland popped off around the murder of Oscar Grant on
Right.
the what we at Oscar Grant Station, Fruitvale BART station. That is when you and I met, was 2009.
No.
Talk about Oscar's murder, your response to it, and what that period of time meant for you politically.
Yeah, that was a very important time, because if we recall, it was right on the heels of the election of Barack Obama, and a lot of people were out in the streets celebrating and feeling like, oh, it's a brand new day, right? But here in Oakland on January 1st, we got a stark reminder of what this country really feels about Black people, by seeing that brutal execution of Oscar on the BART station. And then, that was January 1st when it happened. January 7th comes around. It's been a whole week. We've seen the footage going over and over and over again, and no, nothing from the city, no comments at all from the mayor at the time. And so, yeah, we were part of that first force that rallied up at the scene of the crime, Grant Station in East Oakland. And, and we rallied from Grant Station all the way downtown. The youngsters were tearing it up and doing what they had to do to get attention. Because, again, like I mentioned, a week had gone by of everyone seeing this brutal murder. And yet the city was completely silent. And so it really took the people putting pressure to even have them acknowledge that. And then eventually, obviously, a week later, January 14th, there's another a wave of protests. And then eventually, Meserly, the pig was charged with murder and actually convicted after some time of obviously the trial moving to LA and all that. But what that did for me is it was interesting because there wasn't a lot of rappers out there, to be honest. Later on you see folks identify with the movement, and that's good and well, and I'm not here to knock nobody, but I did note that it was interesting at the beginning there wasn't a whole lot of artists, kind of involved. It was really, the hardcore, activists or organizers of Oakland that were kind of boots on the ground at the beginning. But it took a large coalition building in the process to get ultimately justice, or to fight for justice, because ultimately justice was not had, even though we did win a historical battle in terms of Meserly serving time, for murdering Oscar, and but creating relationships with his friends that were on the platform, with his family, with comrades like yourself. It was very empowering, and it really got us ready for the wave that we would see coming later on, and places like Ferguson and Minneapolis with George Floyd. Like, this is all after that fact, but I think in many ways, the Justice for Oscar Grant movement was a new iteration of the time in terms of fighting back against police terrorism and being clear that it's not police brutality, it's really terrorism, and tying it to a whole lot of different campaigns and conditions in the city. So I think you emerged as a leader during that time, which was beautiful to see as well. And yeah, it's just awesome to see, to this day, we have organizations such as ATPT, Anti-Police Terror Project, CRC, Community Ready Corps. All of that was kind of birthed out of the Oscar Grant movement, and really a lot of what I do, even with my music as well, was informed by that, because a lot of times I was asked to perform at the protests. Well, if I'm gonna perform at the protests, I'm not gonna just rap about whatever, it's gotta be some relevant bars, and I've kind of kept that with me ever since, and that's in tune with the Black Panther Party Cubs code of culture as well. So it's definitely a powerful time, you know. Long live Justice for Oscar Grant movement.
Yeah, just a couple things to move on, right? We never call it justice because the only justice would have been Oscar Grant sitting at the dinner table, you know,
Facts.
with his mama. I also really appreciate Mama Wanda. I also really appreciate you talking about that. It was the young people that set that off. When I talk a lot, right, and I go back to 2009, which, hey, you know, when I'm talking to these fresh faced 18-year-olds, a lot of them, they have no idea who Oscar is. And I tell them, I said, you know, there's no shade because there's been so many names since then. If you figure the state murders, 1,300 people a year on average, that's what we know. That's a lot of names since 2009, right? You do 1,300 times 17. That's a lot of people. But the other thing that I said, there's a lot of nonprofits that want to take credit for that movement.
Hey.
That they set that off. Nah, y'all came in to try to tame the youth. Y'all came in
How to
to try
water
to
it down.
quell the movement. Y'all came in because Dellums was tired and exasperated, and he said, help. And y'all said, okay, we'll help. But y'all didn't start that movement. You sure didn't sustain it,
Facts. I
respectfully.
remember calling out. Appreciate you, raising that contradiction, because I remember calling it out because some of those same forces in the nonprofit world here in Oakland, years before, were working on how to effectively protest for the Iraq invasion in 2004. Some of those same forces were now telling the youth, no, not teaching them the tactics about how to protest effectively, but actually telling them to stay home and
Go
warn,
inside.
right, worrying
Remember
about
when they tried to move us inside to the community centers?
insane. And it wasn't happening. They brought all kinds of, rappers out and all kinds of people. But the youth, again, credit to the Oakland youth, man. They were fired up and they were not having it,
I think the other thing that's important about that time is that I didn't even realize probably until a few years ago talking about that time, it was that also collided with the recession, right? So people were, the poor were already poorer, the hungry were already hungrier. Dellums, poor baby. Right? They should have just left him.
what he was doing.
He was tired. He
Right.
was tired, right? Well, we just leave it at that. Brother was tired. And right, the Oakland Police Department at that point in time, prior to the movement for justice for Oscar Grant, was one of the most murderous police departments in the state. So they were killing
Facts.
black folks left, right, brown folks, black folks left, right, center. And so I think all of those things, like when people talk about, well, how come that? When families ask me, well, how come Oscar and not my family? We have to remember the conditions.
No doubt. Yeah, that was fresh off the Rioters case. When folks could look it up, the Oakland Rioters was, basically straight terrorists in the form of police officers in West Oakland. They were doing all kinds of crazy stuff, and it continues to happen, with the human trafficking that the OPD has been involved in as well. You know what I mean? It's years and years and years, decades of corruption going all the way back to October of 1966, why the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense was created,
Ross, when did you discover hip hop?
Oh man, as a youth, as a young kid, it was I can remember my cousins and their friends rapping Lotti Dottie, at a house party or something like that, and then first tried to break dance, a little kid throwing linoleum out there trying to break dance. I wasn't very good at it. And then a little later on, kept my hand at a graffiti art, wasn't very good at it. By junior high, I actually started a DJ crew. I never had my own turntables, but it was a DJ crew. We were called Thundercuts, and we would do like open mics and house parties and stuff like that. And because I didn't have my own turntables, I ended up getting on the mic a lot, and it kind of turned my poetry essentially into freestyle rapping. And back then, this is the 90s, early mid 90s, so it was a lot of battle rapping and stuff like that. So kind of through those iterations, as I mentioned, those are the four elements of hip hop culture, right? With the fifth being knowledge. So I always consider myself a practitioner of all elements of hip hop culture, since I was a youth.
I wonder if that's an MC Journey story, because my dude has a similar story. Like, he was going to break dance.
Right.
And you
I'm
see his
telling
list.
you.
I'm going to do my homework and I'm going to do this and I'm going to break dance. And
Right.
he wasn't good at that
Hey,
either.
it's those different generations, man. We get exposed to different things, you know what I mean? From the 80s to the 90s, 2000s. And that's what I love about hip hop culture is every generation kind of redefines it, you know what I mean? Yeah.
My early associated memories with you, because we both also move in this world, is actually your connection to reggae music and Rastafari. And talk about that influence in your life and your participation in that culture and the merging.
No
You might
doubt.
actually be one of the first artists, it might be true, the first artist that I actually witnessed. I think it was at Pier 23. Was that bar, Pier
Pier 23,
29, or whatever it is over there?
Frisco. Yeah.
And I came to see you, just me and my ex came to see you perform, and it was this merge of these two cultures that I was deeply in love with and a part of, and it was amazing. Talk
Right
about that.
on. Yeah, definitely. And in fact, this past weekend, this past Sunday, I performed with Jahdan Blackamore from Guyana, an excellent artist. You know, me, him, and Tough Like Iron sisters out here from Jamaica. We performed in Frisco at the Crucial Reggae Sundays at the Bandshell, Golden Gate Park. And the same thing, they had their reggae song, and I just kicked my little rap over it, you know. And really, that goes back to my crew out in Santa Ana, we're known as Ross Youth Internationals, and they were older. They're about 5, 10 years older than me, the guys that took me under their wing when I was a teenager. And they were mostly formerly gang impacted individuals that many of became Rastafarian. And because of that heavy Rasta influence, it was able to like kind of shift my way of thinking and show me a different path. And so even though we were making hip hop music, a lot of what we were listening to was reggae. And so we kind of started slowly over time kind of blending the two, you know. We'd go from being in the Naya Bingi with Ross Michael in South Central LA to all of a sudden we're back in the studio and like, yeah, you're gonna feel that influence. Like, all right, well, let's bring out the Kente drum and put it over this beat. You know what I mean? And though we're not from Jamaica, you know what I mean? Or some of my brethren were, but you know, myself, I'm not. So really not putting on the accent or anything like that, but mostly just rapping over the instrumentals or the rhythms, as we call it, you know what I mean? But since that time, spending a lot of time going to Jamaica has very much influenced and impacted my work. You know, I work really closely with one of my favorite artists that I grew up listening to, is now one of my, you know, closest friends, which is Sizzla Kalungi, who just celebrated his 30th year anniversary this past weekend as well out in Kingston. 30 years in the music, you know, and you know, part of Judgment Yard, so I help him with the Sizzla Youth Foundation. So all last summer we were out in Jamaica doing back to school giveaways for the youth and the grill and in Kingston and all over. You know what I mean? And so very much, it's the consciousness, I think, is the key connector between hip hop and reggae. You know, making music with a message, the genres kind of don't really matter as much as what you represent and what you stand for, you know. And so we just interpret it in different languages with different vibrations with the music. And I'm open to it all. But again, like I say, I try to keep it authentic so I don't go too far outside my own zone lyrically and vocally. You know what I mean?
Thank you for the XMP. I don't know what it is in the Bay Area. I don't know what that is. But boy, I done
Right.
heard some of the most interesting renditions of Trinidadian accents, which, you know, is the culture I'm rooted in, Jamaican accents. It's an interesting phenomenon out here.
Yeah.
Of course, I'm not surprised. The time is ticking fast. And I want to give you some time to talk about what you're working on right now. What's your latest project? What did you just drop? What it's about? What's
Yeah,
moving?
thanks. Yeah, my newest song right now is called Disinfo Age.
Abolish them. Unjust laws got a right to not acknowledge them. It's probably some agent surveilling me writing this verse, but it could always get worse. Living in these times.
Short for Disinformation Age, you know, and I just really felt like I wanted to make a song for the times right now, you know. Like, it's really hard for me to like think about making and creating music that's not relevant, you know what I mean? Like, it has to be relevant. I mean, that's part of that whole code of culture piece that Chairman Fred Hampton Jr. challenged us with, you know, 20 years ago, but we're still on it, right? So Disinfo Age is produced by a young producer here in the Bay named AKA Frank, who's down with the HPK gang. And Frank is a phenomenal young producer, man. I come to him with some, you know, random samples, and he's able to flip it and give it kind of a little Bay twist to it. So I hope folks enjoy it. Yeah, so Disinfo Age, that's a new one, and it's another single from this new solo project that I'm basically completed with, which in many ways is a Wu-Tang spin-off. I have a lot of production and features from members of the Wu-Tang Clan and family. Working a lot. I'm a member of the Killer Bees family now, which has been a really interesting development over the past couple of years, based off of my work going to New York City and also connecting with really like a lot of different members of the Wu. So you can find that. I released an album last year called Jacket Full of Metals with Timbo King from Brooklyn, who's also a Wu-Tang Killer Bee. So that's been amazing as well, being able to work again with folks that I grew up listening to. And you know, so folks can check it out. I've basically been dropping like dang near a single a month for a while now. But they can get ready for the album. A lot of videos on YouTube, just giving people the content, man. Just staying busy, you know, for sure.
I love that, and I do. I talk about him a lot because he makes me happy. But my guy, same thing. Just gives does, makes the music for the message and to give it
Yeah,
away, and that's so critical
it really is.
right now. And on that, I'd actually want you to end by talking a little bit more about the code of culture. What is our job as artists? What are we supposed to be doing with our gifts?
Definitely, definitely. Like when I think about the code of culture, it really goes back. The first code of culture piece I ever made was actually the Free the SF8 song. So this is back in like 2006. If folks remember, the SF8 were eight individuals. Some were Black Panther Party veterans, some Black Liberation Army veterans, but all grandfathers, elders essentially that got charged with a bogus crime in San Francisco for a murder of a police officer from like the 1970s. Anyway, most of them got released on those charges, but at the time we were asked to make a song for the campaign, and I had never thought about doing that before. Sure, I'll reference Mumia or Leonard Peltier, free Mumia, still free them all. And in solidarity, shout to Leonard, who's home now. You know,
Yes.
we mentioned those cases in our songs, but we never had a song strictly focused on a case, right? And so that was a challenge. It's like, all right, make a song or make music that is really relevant to the community, and not only that, and actually get involved. So we didn't just make the song, we actually showed up at the court date. We actually, had correspondence with the brothers while they were inside. So that's still kind of the challenge of code of culture that's always on my heart is like, all right, make sure it's relevant, but then make sure we're also not just talking about it, right? And it's not lip service. We're actually putting work behind our words, which I think is very critical and crucial. So yeah, we continue to do that. The code of culture is on and going, ongoing, right? Like this past August 30th, for Chairman Fred Hampton Day, we was out there in Chicago and finally got the Chairman Fred
Yeah.
street sign put up right at Ground Zero, where him and Defense Captain Mark Clark were assassinated on December 4th, 1969. Then tomorrow we're getting here in Oakland, we're getting Chairman Bobby Seale Day, October 22nd for his birthday, getting the street sign for him. It's like, these things, while they may seem like just symbolic, there's a lot of work that goes behind that, because I remember even in Chicago, there was years where, previous regimes, oh, there'll never be a street sign for Chairman Fred, And I think it takes the propaganda, it takes things like creating a movie like Judas and the Black Messiah by doing, making the Hampton House this very visible place for the people. Even here, doing the work with the whether it's the Huey P. Newton Foundation or, just the work that is going to continue on the legacy of the Panther Party that says, yeah, we're gonna have a statue for Minister Huey now. We're gonna have a street sign for Chairman Bobby. These are not things that the state is just gonna give us, right? So it's like that's all part of code of culture. It's like pushing, 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 and the whole definition of power, right, is a defining phenomenon and making it act in a desired manner. So we still trying to get that.
And I think the other thing that has to be said is yes, it's the continued pushing and one of the gifts that Chairman Jr. has given us, one of the mandates that he has given us is strict adherence to the politics.
Man.
So it's actually not just about uplifting the culture of the party because that gets dangerous. And
True.
we could have a conversation about why in the town is dangerous right now, but I'm not going to go there because we don't have time.
Yeah.
But there's some things that are not actually the business,
No, you're
right?
right.
And
You're right.
so when you see that picture of Chairman Fred Jr. and the mayor of Chicago holding the sign with Chairman Senior's name on it, that's not a concession to the state power. That's a concession of the state to the politics
Thank
that
you.
he has held down and given us a mandate to hold down as well. So I had to get that in there
No,
for
I appreciate
folks.
that reminder again, because the political reality is not to be compromised ever, right? And that's what folks oftentimes do with the legacy as well. So that's also as artists, like making sure that stuff I'm doing is not going out of pocket, but it's actually like staying on code. It's very critical. Not everybody does it, but I think it's a duty and responsibility to adhere to that. And I definitely hear what you're saying in terms of some of the some of the watering down that is attempting to happen. But luckily we got folks like yourself, that are here to keep things in line, and we deal with the elders, right? Like we hear from them,
I'm
like
accountable to people, right? And so I will be
accountability.
conspicuously, there's places that you just ain't gonna see Cat. And you'd be like, why ain't Cat here? Well, now you know.
Right.
Because there's a question about the politics. All right, let me stop before
Yeah.
I get myself in trouble. But I will
Yeah.
say this one last thing. I got a tattoo of the Panther with the year 1966 on my cap. This is how serious I take this.
Yes.
As the artist was finishing up the tattoo, and I had a panic attack. I had a panic attack because I had not gotten permission.
Oh, okay.
Right? Like that's how,
Yeah.
but that's how serious we have to take, right? Like
Right.
I after the fact, I went and checked in, but you know what I mean? But like
Yeah.
that's the
Well, certain
discipline we
moves
gotta
I don't
have,
make.
y'all,
Like
you
even
know?
in 2022, I had an album called To Serve the People. Initially, I wanted to call it Servant of the People. But then I went through the lines with my comrades and it went through the
I
committee.
remember that. Yeah.
Yeah, it was like, actually, nah, let's not do it like that. It's called To Serve the People, because again, serving other people, it has a politic behind that. There's a certain history behind that. And as an artist, I'm not trying to compromise that in any way. And again, that democratic centralism, folks are really opposed to that, and especially artists. We're so ego driven, and it's like all the vision, right? But it's like, nah, it's bigger than you as an individual, and that's something that I always take heed to. And I'm thankful to be raised around real freedom fighters, you know what I mean? And still held accountable by those forces, to where we don't go out of pocket and think it's all about us, because that's the capitalist way, is just
Right.
individualism, but what we understand is collectivism, and we all we got a
That's
lot.
right. Where do we find you, Ross? Where do people, I know where to find you. Where do people find you? They want
Yeah,
more.
y'all can find me everywhere at just RASCEYLON, on all social media and all streaming platforms or whatever. Folks want to reach out to me about any work, just RossCelon at Gmail. Just holler at me, man. If you see me in traffic, just throw that fist up and we can build.
And that's a wrap, fam bam. You've been listening to Law and Disorder. I'm your host, Kat Burks. This week's feature is hip hop artist, educator, MC, and community advocate, Ross Ceylon. Brother, thank you.
Bless up. Give thanks. Bring them on.
Bring them all.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA, that's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. Our Resistance in Residence theme music was composed by Jesse Strauss. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA, that's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listeners. If you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.